very much agree with a lot of the opportunities and the promise of space for sustainable development, and I think you've heard a lot of what space can do. So I take the opportunity of this talk to rather focus a bit more on some of the constraints and some reflections for the supply side of the space community. As such, I want to spend a little bit of a time, less than 10 minutes each, probably hopefully 7 minutes each, to set up a little bit the context of international development and the SDGs with a sort of a theory of change and a problem statement to, I think, provoke the space community to look at this and frame it slightly differently. Then I'll get very practical about concrete examples in Tanzania. And then I want to provide some reflections that I think may have some policy implications or not. So we've all seen this several times in the last 2 days. I won't talk about what space can do, but simply to articulate that as World Bank, we are guided by these sustainable development goals, and in particular focused on two: to eradicate extreme poverty and to boost shared prosperity. So that's articulated in our mission statement, which is relatively new from our new, well, not so new president, Jim King. And he said that the mission is to end extreme poverty within a generation and boost shared prosperity. So for those who are not very familiar with what the World Bank is an institution, we are a lending and grant-giving financial institution, but we are guided really by trying to bring down extreme poverty, the number of persons living under $1.25 a day, to 3% or less by 2030, and boosting shared prosperity, which is really focusing on the growth of the bottom 40% in all developing countries. The context for this is that the world has been eradicating poverty steadily, mostly thanks to growth in East Asia, especially China, as well as falling fertility rates. But the job in Africa is quite different as a picture. So we really see the agenda for 2030 increasingly emphasizing sub-Saharan Africa in terms of these two goals. In terms of financial flows, for context still, the World Bank operates within the official development assistance, and that's projected last year as $135 billion, of which $60 billion is from the World Bank Group as a whole. So we're less than half. And this is $60 billion that is a mixture of grants, credits, and loans. So there are really several institutions that make up the World Bank Group. When people think of the World Bank, they mean the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. And this provides access at subsidized rates for developing countries to international capital markets. What that means is we issue treasury bonds and an extremely good credit rating because the bank is guaranteed by its member states. So 186 member states need to go bankrupt before the bank goes bankrupt, in theory. As such, we can offer loans that are 0.25% above LIBOR to middle-income countries on condition it fits a poverty reduction strategy, conforms to environmental safeguards, social safeguards, non-military, non-nuclear, another example. So this is really for middle-income countries, Latin America, East Asia, countries that are on their way to development but still could not themselves afford to go to the capital markets for most of what they do. And this is infrastructure for roads, schools, agriculture, institutions, and so on. But we also have something called the International Development Association, and this is grant money from donors. So traditionally, when you see countries announcing how much money they will be giving for child nutrition, for malaria, etc., some of that might be going into the World Bank through IDA, and that's grant money. So when you see the map of where we work and how much we spend, the $15 billion, the largest region of sub-Saharan Africa, that's almost entirely grants. And then in some of the other regions, it'll be a blend between grants and loans and credits. Complementing this is the idea that we provide technical assistance. So if I go back to the international financial flows, what the World Bank really emphasizes is that in the long run, what countries need to do is unlock their domestic resources, their tax base. So there's a lot of advice and technical assistance on building tax regimes, good governance, good institutions, as well as attracting private sector investment. So how to unlock that, the business climate environment, for example. So that's a little bit the flavor of what the World Bank is, I hope. And I come back to the SDGs and what I think is interesting about the SDGs in the context of the technical and data revolution. This is the themes that were chosen for the high-level panel of eminent persons in 2013 in the run-up to the SDGs. And you see inclusion, sustainable development, growth, and jobs, fairly traditional topics. But I thought it was interesting that they really emphasized open government and institutions and mass collaboration as two important themes. And when you read that report, for me, it sort of stands out everywhere as a technologist. References and language to say disruption, paradigm shift, harness technology and innovation. It's clear they're calling for a business as unusual approach. It's clear that the existing path we're on is not going to cut it. So one of the charts we saw yesterday with all the SDGs, and you saw a handful, maybe okay, majority, we need a revolution, another handful, we need a U-turn. That's really comes through in the report, but there isn't a really clear, articulate strategy of what about technology and innovation? How exactly? It's implicit in openness and collaboration. So they actually made a call for something they call the Data Revolution for Sustainable Development. New international initiative to provide the quality of statistics and information to citizens to actively take advantage of new technology, crowdsourcing, improved connectivity to empower people with information and progress. So it's really about a step change in the number of active participants in their own development process. And that permeates through to all the UN agencies and other charters when we have something now called the Global Partnerships for the Data Revolution. And if you look at the UN GGIM Addis Ababa Declaration, that comes through. They call for embracing open data and standards to collate, share, and distribute geospatial information. And for a little bit more background on what I think is a bit of a theory of change here, you know, we take inspiration from what's happened on the internet, which has changed from the one of the 90s, right? And this is a slightly crass way to say that, you know, we've moved from a mass publishing paradigm of one-way information to mass participation. Now, this has really transformed Western businesses, digital markets, and we're beginning to see it also affecting developing country, both public and private sectors. And the most evident cases of this is the value and sheer number of services and users daily that log in. There are more FaceTube videos watched per day than there are people on the planet. A lot of these consumers are creating content. We're sharing our location, we're sharing our preferences, we're sharing our social networks, our purchases. And these companies are in the multi-billion dollar values and they have multi-billion user platforms. More people log into Facebook, I think it's now 1 billion people a day, active users of Facebook. You know, in the United States, you can't get the majority of the population to file their tax return on time once a year, but you can get 1 billion people a day to tell you what they had for breakfast or which movie they liked. So in this context, the role of government and a lot of the discussion in ICT4D world is about embracing the rise of openness as a standard for enabling mass participation. Open data, and for those not familiar with it, open data is all about simplifying it, making it user-friendly. It's discoverable, accessible, and reusable data, technically and legally. Open standards, open APIs, platforms. We heard Dr. Ashberger talk about, instead of sending the data to people, bring the algorithm in, do the analysis, bring it back. This requires a lot of effort to standardize information services, platforms, open innovation. So we now operate in the world of open development, if you like, and there is, in fact, an open development World Bank website. This is not their definition. This is the earliest literature definition I could find. But it really says that the open information networked activities offer an emerging set of possibilities for change. So the open development hypothesis is that new models of engagement and innovation can come about from greater participation, greater collaboration, and being more user-driven. And my final conceptual slide, and I'll get to some practical examples. This is from Henry Chesbrough, Adapted, the open innovation model. But what we really say is you have a set of prototypes, ideas, people that are exploring, defining the concept. We think of it as a linear process of input-output results, but really it's a messy process of iteration, evolution, and you focus on a particular service. Now, with open innovation, there are two different pathways to create better value. One, a lot more eyeballs, a lot more ideas, a lot more people looking at your problem can enhance, perhaps upgrade, your problem statement. So I like to give two examples, Barcelona and Chicago. Chicago wired up all the trash cans in 2009 and released the data on a Twitter feed of which trash containers were full. Barcelona did something similar with the parking spots but didn't release it openly. So in Barcelona, you have one guy looking at one problem, the parking meter rate or the number of parking spots that should be zoned or allowed in the city. So you're relying on his ability to do the analysis with that data to solve one problem. In Chicago, they thought, lots more people looking at the trash cans, maybe we get a better, more efficient trash collection system, maybe people propose different routes, smaller trucks, more frequency, etc. But what they didn't anticipate is Starbucks would take the data as a proxy for economic density transactions on the street corner and use it to value the franchises of the next Starbucks. Completely different value proposition, right? But really interesting. The frequency of which the trash container fills up is your best indicator at that resolution of how much money is changing hands, which is very valuable for shops. So as a utility, it's great. That would never happen in Barcelona because the data wasn't open. So there's a challenge statement here. There's a problem, right? Adoption of new things, as the marginal cost of innovation and services goes to zero, the comparative advantage to be the innovator is the startup. It's the person with nothing to lose. It's the person who can take this risk, and you have 1,000 startups, whereas large institutions and governments have legacy. 30, 40 years ago, the first mainframe computer, the first desktop computer, the first satellite phone, it would come through your research institution, your employer, the military. 5, 10 years ago, I went to work at the World Bank. Skype was banned in the office, but at home I could use Skype, WhatsApp, Facebook, etc. So there's a shifting role where governments no longer are going to be the first adopters. They're shifting to a platform of innovation. And they also struggle to deal with the pace of the Industrial Revolution, the new information revolution, right? I mean, the World Bank talks very eloquently about this mobile phone being a poverty reduction killer, the most valued asset of the poor. But 2 years before those speeches were made, people were telling me, mobile phone is a luxury. The poor, they need protein. They need education. So we fail to see these things coming. We fail to really adopt technology foresight. Wikipedia was launched in 2001 and overtook Encyclopedia Britannica in 2004. And these are billion-person platforms. I still sometimes get people telling me that if it doesn't only works on a smartphone, it's not useful for Africa. Rubbish. Look at the trends. Every urban adult in a profession has a smartphone today in Tanzania. Every urban adult has a regular phone. 80% cell phone penetration in Tanzania, 20% per year growth. So we need to do a better job on foresight. And I would say that the World Bank has an ICT policy from 2001, updated in 2012. The number of paradigm shifts in between is staggering. So I come back to the space segment. Yes, I think space applications for sustainable development exist. There's a value proposition. It's compelling. And it's primarily in communications, remote sensing, navigation. I'll leave space resources aside. But you have this policy note between the supply side and the demand side. And what I would say is the demand side doesn't see this, right? The demand side isn't really asking for space communication, space location. They're asking for information, communications, and localization, right? In general, they're agnostic to the source. So there's this bigger data revolution context of which space is an unseen, although important and foundational enabler. And this is leading to, I think, in my theory of change, the change in production model. You're enabling now this commons-based peer production, to use some economic jargon, but what I mean is mass participation to create value in a way that it's overtaking traditional models. So the best example is OpenStreetMap, I think, or the most compelling one. I started presenting this at the World Bank in 2010 when it was at 250,000 users, and I was predicting 500,000. People said, no way, it's never going to happen. It's already crossed almost 3 million. So this is interesting to show because a couple of days ago I was at Esrin, and one of the university projects was showing an analysis of land use, land cover extracted from OpenStreetMap compared to Sentinel applications, both current and there's an urban one. And across the board in highly developed cities, OpenStreetMap is far more up to date and you can produce the same products at a very low marginal cost. But I want to show a little bit what we see in Africa. So this is just a video to liven up. The edits for African cities and Africa as a whole in the period of 2013 to 15. Bear in mind, Africa was almost black as an OpenStreetMap continent in 2012. So we've really seen an explosion of users in developing countries. These lightning flashes are edits to labels or additions of infrastructure. And you see volunteers that were adding small pieces, houses, etc., but you see larger data sets going online as well, which really symbolizes the official mapping agencies or those with the largest amount of data beginning to export to OpenStreetMap their data sets, beginning to use it as the default platform for sharing. So this is Sierra Leone. Many of these traces will be derived from satellite imagery. But across all the capital cities, there are active street mapping communities. And my hometown. Which I'm happy to say is much better than Google Maps at the moment. So this brings me to the cases and focus on Tanzania. I'm going to give a case study. I was asked to speak about drones, but I tried to reference it in a complement or within the broader geospatial market. In particular, I'll talk a little bit about geospatial and communications. So the project is called Ramani Huria, which is Swahili for the free map. And the context is massive unplanned urbanization. 75% of Dar es Salaam is unplanned. It's the second fastest growing city in Africa. Mwanza is 80% unplanned, fastest growing. Also, the majority of population is 15 or under. So the working population is going to treble in 15 years. And we have 1.2 million formal jobs, and we're about to receive 26 million people into the workforce. So there's a huge urban migration and jobs crisis, informality, complex governance systems, lack of trash collection is contributing to the lack of drainage functionality, contributing to flooding. So we see not just frequently increasing floods, but the flood waters are really contaminated. Mosquito and waterborne disease, human defecation, any number of health issues. And it's a complex form of service failure. On the data side, this is the best risk map of Dar es Salaam right now, which is not very impressive. There's a lack of data. The informality is a challenge, inconsistent data, and very weak local capacities. So when we talk about what we can do in theory, is very much constrained about the practical realities of how things work. So Ramani Huria has several multiple goals at once: skills, data, engagement. And mixing them all together is really quite essential to making this work. The goal is to use OpenStreetMap and handheld GPS units to tag every single building for its use. Public, private, commercial, industrial, schools, water points, toilets, especially drains, especially zones that flood frequently. So we use 150 urban planning students, 100 Red Cross volunteers, and 100 community members to map the city. And they walk around in slums and places like this with community members articulating issues, articulating features, but trained to identify what our flood risk infrastructure investment needs and features. And I'm rushing a little bit. And so one of the important things is community-driven risk scenarios, flood scenarios. So this is not modeled. This is where they tell us where is flooding, which can then translate when we have the exposure map into the number of houses affected, how much of these businesses, how much of these vulnerable populations, where is the school, where is the shelter, where are the public facilities, as well as general area maps, drainage maps, other land use maps. And in the official maps, you can only see the two main roads here. This is a place called Tandale. It's about 90,000 people. It's the biggest informal area of Dar es Salaam. However, the data by itself doesn't scale because we do need comparability across wards, and these scenarios are very subjective from the communities. So we use the drones. And the drones, I was worried that would be too much of a gimmick, maybe distracting from the real valuable community process. But actually, I'm really hooked on the drones now. So this is the town planner for Kilindoni, one of the councils, holding one of the drones. She would never use satellite imagery. For her, it's a bit too complex, a bit too alien. It's prone to sort of rent-seeking behaviors. You know, information is power. People will say, I have to have it. I'm the GIS person. I'll make the map on my terms. So there's a number of incentive as well as capacity issues. But with the drone, the comparative advantage shifts the people in the field to the local government and to the user. It's very simple to operate. It takes thousands of photos with a commercial consumer camera that has a GPS geolocation for each picture. It creates an orthomosaic, a flat map, as well as an elevation model using a reverse stereoscopic effect. So you get beautiful high-resolution pictures of the city. And so now I show a quick video that really illustrates the drone program rather than talking too much about the slides. And this is filmed from drones about drones. It's actually in a rural area. It's not about our urban flood risk program, but hopefully you get the same information. so it's cloud-free imagery.
When we come back to the office, we take the photograph, use a piece of software which manages the geolocation with the photograph, and launch it into another piece of software which takes all of the images.
The drones are substitutes for manned aircraft and helicopters, but complements the satellites at different scales. So we can't map the whole country at that quality. But it is driving new markets, it's really getting engagement, and because they're relatively simple, it's having a very hands-on process with local data technicians, geospatial specialists. So back to Dar es Salaam, obviously the exposure map and the elevation model are critical for a consistent flood risk assessment across the city. But we think that the community data is the more important hook, and that's the harder piece to really establish. There's also this emerging area of Internet of Things and ground-based in-situ sensors. So just to show, we've used a Trimble camera that is a substitute for the Google Street View, running on a little bajaj, like a rickshaw, that has also been doing ground-based street view mapping as well. So in combination, the in-situ mapping, the community knowledge, and the drones and the satellite gives us a very powerful use case. But the participation is driving the communities. When we talk about mass collaboration, we have local mapping parties. And we had an earthquake on Saturday, so a lot of people were mapping those towns in western Tanzania, including the missing maps community. So someone spoke earlier about missing maps, MSF colleague. So I'm glad to say Tanzania is part of the missing maps collaboration. I'm going to skip Zanzibar very quickly because I've been asked to cut down the time. But to say we're looking to map all of Zanzibar in a multi-application process. Now, Zanzibar's satellite imagery and aerial photography was done in 2004 for $2 million at 20 centimeters resolution. We're trying to repeat that at 7 centimeters everywhere, plus 2.5 centimeters for the urban areas, and hoping to do it for less than $200,000. So it's two orders of magnitude, if you like, improvement in cost performance. It's the most ambitious drone mapping project that I know of. But although it's multi-purpose, it's really, again, driven by urban planning and land tenure consideration. So we need to find the client, we need to find the market, and the authoritative user. There's lots of really cool things you can do once you get the data out and open, including interesting land conflict situations, coastal zone, marine environment, and so on. This is a landfill site in a quarry, and volumetric analysis, and so on. So in conclusion for the project, there's two things we think we need to do. We want to build a flying lab first, because that's where the real demand is. Startups, entrepreneurs come and get certified and qualified in operating a drone. They rent the equipment, they get the permit, they can rent the processing computers, they get implementation support, and they can run their own businesses. So there's a big market case, and we've committed to fund one in partnership with Rockefeller Foundation and something called We Robotics. Around that, we would like to, we've begun the process, but this is not committed, to then layer the space segment and the ground in situ data segment as complements for something that ESA calls a climate lab. So whilst Tanzania is not a member state of ESA, we're hoping we can arrange a kind of cooperation to get access to thematic exploitation platforms, skills, training courses, curricula, and possibly even something called ESA quality seal, for example. But the idea is that drone operators will find the satellite imagery a viable complement. They often get requests to go and map a small area. The data's successful, they say, can you map the whole region? And the answer is, no, that's impractical. We can do this more. And how about satellite data for the rest of the region? So, conclusions. Number one, this data revolution is changing the roles of government. So there's this quote from Mike Bracken that says, you know, in an analog world, policy dictates delivery. And Tanzania lives in a very analog government. Master plans for 5 years, that don't bear any reflection of reality. But if we can monitor where people are building in real time, if we can have feedback from sensors about where the flooding is, and this is a map of complaints to local non-emergency 311 number in New York of streetlights, that's data. And that's actionable data, and it's near real-time data. So it changes the relationship of government to being a sort of always-on reactionary policy. These are real 3D printed water sensors in Tanzania for flow and streamfall, and a real open source water supply dashboard. It doesn't use the sensor data yet, but my dream is we'll be plugging it in. We're trying to use mobile money purchase data. So when people stop buying water at a water point with their mobile money phone, you can infer that it's not working. 50% of all the water points in Tanzania don't work, but we don't know which ones. So the challenge is intelligence. Remote sensing can help, but we're also going to be looking at sales data, sensor data, all sorts of feedback loops, and human complaints data. Local capacity is really important. This picture is nice because the gentleman in the orange shirt works for the Commission on Science and Technology and is teaching this land surveyor in Zanzibar how to use the drone. So we had an NGO come down a year ago and did the first mapping, and now everything is locally designed, locally driven, locally run, which is fantastic. I mentioned foresight. One area we're seeing getting very congested now is appetite for drones. I did a lot of mapping drones, but we're seeing, for example, cargo drones. Rwanda has already signed for 3 drone ports to carry medicines dropped by parachute to cover, I think it's 90% of the population at the moment. At the moment, dropping just blood for transfusions. But what we're really seeing is this development of airspace as a natural resource, similar to spectrum or to orbital slots, where countries are beginning to explore how do we regulate drones, but how do we auction off airlines for drones, or, you know, different paths in the air, different flight routes as a resource. I was very bullish about the phones and the growth and the adoption of technology, but I do have to say that the bank, officially, we still have a position on the digital divide. There are still a lot of people that may have a phone, but they don't have a data signal. It's a feature phone. So we need to do something about the digital divide. I believe that most market forces are going to bring this quite a long way still, but there are some market failures, and there's still a case for public subsidy. And there's a divide also within countries. It's primarily rich urban men, so you'll find older rural women will be the most disconnected. And that's important because more information, more connectivity, more location services can be more innovation, more efficiency, more inclusion, but it can also do the opposite. There is a risk that we're empowering the elite. Maybe it's the one industrialized farm that is using your farm knowledge to exploit the local smallholder farms and buy them out cheap. So what we call analog complements, skills, institutions, regulation, law, really matter if you want to avoid elites using technology for greater concentration, inequality, and control. And my final slide is, you know, on that theme, the internet used to be an anonymous sort of place in 1993. Now there's two-way flow of information. Most people give away a lot more than they realize. So we have safeguards for environment, for endangered species, for biodiversity when we do a project and we do environmental impact assessments. We have safeguards for social, you know, minority groups and communities. And I think probably this does not exist yet. It's not an official position of the bank. But my personal view is we need to develop a view of digital risks as a safeguards policy as well. Privacy, security, censorship. So there is something called the Digital Development Principles, which have been signed now by 50 organizations working with technology and development. And I suggest it might be an interesting thing for the space community, especially those trying to work with users, to look at. And it's really about making sure that digital access is affordable, open, safe, and inclusive. And what we call, you know, future-proofing. So it's really built around the user and the problem statement. And our colleague yesterday said, understand your problem is the first thing you have to do. Right, but then understand the ecosystem, and the ecosystem is not space segment service users. It's bigger than that. There's a lot of other players. There are complements and substitutes. Build for sustainability, be data-driven, use open tools, focus on the reuse case, but think about privacy, security, and collaboration. Thank you.